In an 11-page statement that was released yesterday, serial bomber Eric Rudolph described the details behind his attacks on abortion clinics, a gay nightclub, and the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. He also outlined his plans for more bombings. He refuted claims that he was affiliated with a white supremacist religious group, that he'd been a big-time drug dealer, and he qualified his views on homosexuality. Rudolph was captured in 2003 near Murphy, North Carolina, while rummaging through a dumpster. He'd been hiding in the surrounding wilderness for 5 years before he was caught. If you have questions or comments on Rudolph's capture or on his guilty plea, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us an email, TOTN@NPR.org. What do we now know that we didn't about Eric Rudolph, his motivations, his 5 years on the run? Mark Potok is director of the Intelligence Project of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he's been following Rudolph's case since the beginning, and he joins us now from his office at the Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. Nice to talk to you today.
Well, thanks for having me.
What was your what did we learn from Rudolph's statement that we didn't know before?
Well, that he is very intent on kind of glorifying himself, in my opinion. I think the statement boiled down to an attempt to kind of strip away from himself the uglier parts of his ideology. You're quite right. You said in the introduction that he had kind of disavowed his connection to Christian identity, which is just a desperately racist and anti-Semitic theology that essentially says that Jews are biologically satanic, descended from Satan, and a number of other things. I think the reality is that Rudolph is a believer in Christian identity, and there's a lot to suggest that's true. I mean, we uncovered many years ago evidence that he had been a follower of a man named Nord Davis, now deceased, who lived very near where he and his family lived in North Carolina. He also spent about 6 months on a kind of infamous Christian identity compound in Missouri, in Shell City, Missouri. In his statement, he says he was only there because of a particular girl he was dating. He was a teenager at the time. Mm-hmm. But the fact is his mom brought him there. His mother was very much a kind of religious seeker and, in fact, moved the family from Florida to North Carolina originally to be near this other Christian identity preacher, a man named Nord Davis. I think it's worth remembering stuff that Eric Rudolph did not say in his statement, that, you know, by ninth grade, he was writing Holocaust denial essays, a rather remarkable thing for a kid that young. They used to read in their household a newspaper called The Spotlight, which is principally a Holocaust denial and anti-Semitic publication that went out of business a few years ago. And the list goes on. He also tried to downplay his background as really a fairly big-time marijuana dealer. He grew hydroponic pot up in the mountains of North Carolina, and apparently very, very high-quality pot. I know this in part because I've talked to his sister-in-law, who actually, you know, saw all this going on and knows a great deal about it. He also made a very strange kind of, he had an odd discussion of homosexuality. I mean, the statement essentially says it was all about abortion, but by the way, he opposes homosexuality when it's sort of displayed in public, as opposed to behind closed doors. He's in an odd situation because his brother, Jamie, in fact, is a gay man who lives in the Village in New York City. And Eric was apparently rather friendly with that brother, despite his views on homosexuality.
One of the questions that many people had about Eric Rudolph, particularly his 5 years on the run, was whether he'd been helped by anybody else, whether he'd gotten assistance to elude federal authorities. He says he didn't.
I think the probability is that he did not get at least any organized help. I think it is possible that he got perhaps involuntary help. There's no doubt at all that Rudolph spent a lot of time doing things like burglarizing vacation cabins, hunting cabins that had food and soap and that kind of thing in it. So, he's also about 50 pounds lighter when he was finally caught than when he fled 5 years earlier. On the other hand, I think it has to be said that at one point Rudolph came out of the mountains and approached this man, George Nordman, who runs an organic food store there. And I know Nordman is known to have right-wing views of his own. Now, I'm not accusing him of having illegally aided and abetted Eric Rudolph, but the fact is that Rudolph left Nordman's store with a great deal of food and his truck as well, and Nordman did not report this to the federal authorities for 3 days. So, you know, it's hard to say. I don't think there's any question that Rudolph was seen by many in Western North Carolina as a kind of Butch Cassidy character, good-looking, you know, kind of wild man who was defying all the forces of the federal government, planes, helicopters, dogs, infrared heat detection equipment, and doing it very successfully. So I think he was something of a folk hero.
Well, joining us now is Linda Miller, a reporter for the Murphy newspaper, the Cherokee Scout. And again, Murphy, North Carolina, is the town near the area where Eric Rudolph was hiding out all those years, and it's where he was eventually captured. And Linda Miller joins us from her office in Murphy, North Carolina. Nice of you to be with us today.
Nice of you to be with you.
I understand you just returned from a visit to one of the areas where Eric Rudolph apparently had a hideout?
That's right. He had a hideout overlooking the armory while the task force was here.
The armory in town was the headquarters for the federal task force that was looking for Eric Rudolph.
That's right.
And he had a hideout there?
He had a hideout, and apparently, and has admitted this in his written statement, that he had planted a bomb there and intended to blow it up with the task force out here. So that's pretty interesting, and we just saw where that was. It's on a bluff overlooking the armory, and it's just kind of hard for it's hard to believe that he was watching the men come and go there and planning this out, and came very close to carrying it out, what I understand.
Yeah, there was a bomb found, as I understand it, across the street from the armory.
A 25-pound bomb, and that was the first one that they set off out here. They have found and set off at least 250 pounds of explosives at four or five locations here during this past week. And he apparently did intend to do a lot more, just based on what I've read in his statement and what has been found. So people here are real happy to know that it's all been located, or they believe it's all been located now.
Not just that 25-pound, but more than 200 pounds of explosives buried elsewhere.
That's right.
How are people reacting there? I mean, again, there was the supposition that he had support, if not friends and helpers, in that area.
We hear that so often, and we don't know why this has been perpetuated. We have, since Friday, since we heard the news, and actually we knew a little bit before that because the explosions were happening, most everyone that I've been able to talk to, and I've tried to talk to a wide range of people from different communities in our county, are glad that he's admitted to his guilt. Some think he may have had help, but if there were people who helped, they're elusive to the majority of us because we don't know who that would be. He isn't the folk hero people think, and most people are glad that he was caught, glad he pled guilty. A few are sorry that he isn't going to get the death penalty for the sake of those victims. And most of all, they don't want people to think that this area is like that. Even those who believe in abortion don't condone killing people for it. But most of all, they don't believe that was really all that motivated him to do the things he did.
I wonder... there was the story for a long time was Eric Rudolph eludes federal authorities. Once he did surrender, if there was a sort of Robin Hood element to this surrender, I mean, he gave up. People thought he would be a hardliner, go all the way, force a trial, never confess.
I think they did think that. I think they thought even though they did think he acted alone. For the very reasons that he did everything else that he did, they thought he would carry it through to the end. People are really shocked that he did agree
to a plea bargain,
and we're all thrilled that he's told us where these explosives were hidden because more people could be killed, and now we know that's not going to happen.
And I suspect a lot of people there in Murphy are eager to get back to quieter times.
We really haven't had a tremendous amount of excitement since the capture. Of course, that was a few days of havoc. But they're happy that it's over and that people know that he did it. And if it is alone, that they know that too. Those who are disappointed just hope that the government is certain about there being no further involvement. We don't know that that's so yet, but we'd like to know that.
Mm-hmm. Linda Miller, thanks very much for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
Linda Miller is a reporter for the Murphy newspaper, The Cherokee Scout, and she joined us from her office in Murphy, North Carolina. Mark Potok, she seems to confirm what you were saying earlier, that if there was any help, it sure wasn't a lot of it.
I think that's true. It's quite conceivable that people who, I think it bears mentioning again that, I think he did have some cheering section there for a while. I don't mean to impugn the people of Western North Carolina at all, but first of all, I think opposition to abortion there is really quite strong. And he did have this kind of romantic outlaw look to him.
Well, his own lawyers were planning to, if the case went to trial, use as part of their defense the idea that, running from the feds is part of the culture of
that's
some
right.
in
and
Western
And that's absolutely
North Carolina.
True. I mean, that country, goes all the way back to the Whiskey Rebellion. I mean, it used to be way back when. This was a country where people had stills out in the woods and, shot federal agents who'd come looking for them and so on. So, I mean, there is something of a tradition. Again, not to make too much of it, this is also a very beautiful part of the country filled with vacation homes and people who come from the cities and so on. I think it's true that he pretty certainly didn't have much help at all, if he did have help, whether or not there was widespread sympathy for him.
We're talking about the confession of Eric Rudolph with Mark Potok, director of the Intelligence Project of the Southern Poverty Law Center. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Heather. Heather's with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so glad to know that apparently, at least, Eric Rudolph didn't seem to have much help. And I'm really glad that he's captured and he's not going to carry out any more violence himself. But I'm really concerned that right now his ideas and his views are getting a major national loudspeaker through the media. I'm concerned that, this whole story gets much, it goes well beyond Western North Carolina. It goes well beyond the South. And he's getting a national audience once again. And what I fear is the possibility that this coverage might stir other people with similar views to similar types of action.
Mark Potok, is that something that concerns you?
Well, that has happened. I mean, there have been people like a man named Clayton Wagner, who was running around just a couple of years ago, threatening to murder people who worked in abortion clinics and so on. I don't think that this publicity per se is going to inspire others. I think really it was a rather ignominious end for Eric Rudolph on a couple of different levels. One, I think what the reporter Linda Miller had to say was absolutely true, that I certainly felt the same way, that, we all, I think, expected Eric Rudolph to go out in a blaze of glory in some kind of wild gunfight with the feds, or certainly if he were captured, that he would, like a sort of good soldier along the lines of Tim McVeigh, would go to his death, refusing to say a word.
Name, rank, and serial number.
Yeah, that's right. And in the reality was, he's found scrounging around in a dumpster. He takes really what I think many people in the white supremacist world would see as the coward's way out. When push came to shove, what really motivated Eric Rudolph is he doesn't want to go to the gas chamber. So he's not looking all that much like a hero. And for those who might perhaps think of him even remotely in that way, I think it's worth remembering that this is a guy who stood behind a tree wearing a wig and who watched a police officer lean over his bomb and actually pressed a remote control. In other words, this was not sort of cool and done from a distance. This was Eric Rudolph was right there, waited till Sandy Sanderson leaned down over his bomb and blew this man's body to bits. He's a killer.
Yeah. I guess it is reassuring, I guess, to realize he's not getting any type of martyrdom out of this. I think a lot of times that's what some people who share that kind of zeal are sort of hoping for.
I think that's true, and I think that did happen with McVeigh because of the way McVeigh, courted the death penalty and, kind of went into the gas chamber with a smile on his lips and, that sort of thing.
And you don't get that from a plea bargain.
No.
I think he looks very bad. He's, in the eyes of the movement, he's a guy who gave it all up, who when push came to shove really couldn't face the music.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Heather.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Amy. Amy's with us from Minneapolis.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling to talk about the man who was initially accused.
Richard Jewell.
Right. I don't want to say his name and get him out in the press again. But has he been a part of this process recently, saying, you know, I told you I didn't do it, that kind of thing?
Oh, I think that was settled long ago. I mean, Richard Jewell won libel verdicts or settlements from a great many people, and I think was, you know, very clearly exonerated. And, you know, the FBI made announcements to that effect. You know, all kinds of media organizations had to essentially take back what they'd said and, like I say, in many cases, make payments probably of many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I don't think there's – I think actually the name Richard Jewell has become synonymous with, you know, very bad screw-ups on the part of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if he was paying attention to the trial, if he was a part of the media at all, or if he was just staying away from this.
There was no trial, but it was a plea bargain.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, to the case. Thanks for the call, Amy.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Potocka, thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And Mark Potok is director of the Intelligence Project of the Southern Poverty Law Center and was joining us from his office in Montgomery, Alabama. You can read excerpts of Eric Rudolph's 11-page statement on our website, npr.org. Ira Flatow will be here tomorrow with Science Friday. We'll see you Monday. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.